This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Best way to give a talk is kind of all of us are giving the talk. The arrangement of a speaker and audience or listeners is has a fair amount of tradition behind it, but sort of like traffic lights, it's a matter of kind of convenience. So I'm up here occupying the speaker's seat, but if I'm not occupying it with all of you, then something's off, something's a little wrong. That might mean, for instance, that I what Buddha called, I have a view. Maybe come across that term in Buddhism, drishti in Sanskrit or ditti in Pali, and it means sort of a fixed notion about something, and they can be rather superficial. For instance, I like marmalade and I don't like grapefruit. In a way, those are sort of drishtis, but the ones that really are significant are the ones like, I exist. Or maybe I have a drishti that I am the exalted Dharma speaker trying to help these poor slug-like sentient beings. And I think I've been to some talks that were kind of like that, and maybe I've even given some, in which case I deeply apologize because that was not my intention. So in that sense, our Sendo here it's pretty good because I have some extra cushions because I'm decrepit and have a certain amount of sciatic trouble, so the padding helps, but the idea wasn't to boost me higher than the rest of you guys. Sometimes the arrangements in Dharma halls, of course, there's actually a kind of a throne, and there's a person way up there, and everybody else is kind of way down there. And that can be okay too. I'm not like bad-mouthing those arrangements, because those are meant to be a kind of mandala theater of Shakyamuni Buddha and all the disciples. So it's good also under those circumstances if the person who's occupying the high place doesn't have a view about that. And that way, the Dharma talk belongs to everyone. Just like in a traffic situation, if there weren't a traffic light, there would be a lot of differences of opinion about who gets to cross the intersection. And there would probably be quite a few more collisions and people yelling at each other and so forth. So it's good to have traffic lights just to do something about our natural human tendency to mix things up with one another. So we have this arrangement for this little while. There's a speaker, and then there are other beings who with quiet heart and body mind also are bringing the Dharma talk to life. Because if you weren't here, I wouldn't be here. I think I heard that back in the old days, Kanagiri Roshi, when he was newly arrived in Minnesota, eventually he got someone who would come in, and he showed that person how to be Jiko, the incense carrier. And then sometimes there'd be a Dharma talk, and there'd be Kanagiri Roshi and the incense carrier, and that's it. That's kind of cute in a way. Of course, it didn't stay that way, but that's how they began. And I probably wouldn't do that. If it was just me and an incense carrier, I'd probably say, well, let's just have a cup of tea instead of going through all of this. And not every clergy person I've met would agree. Some say, in fact, Kanagiri Roshi was quite insistent that put on all the robes and light all the candles and arrange everything just as though there were hundreds of Sangha members. And that's also another way to do it, but I think I'm too lazy for that. So I appreciate that you are all here helping give this Dharma talk. And that, of course, implies something about how we connect, how we touch one another. I was thinking the other day about the perennial topic of alienation. You know, we're all so alienated. So a lot of film and literature and poetry and whatnot, you feel this theme in there. Everybody's alienated. Having a bad time. Of course, there are exceptions, but I think if you were to do a survey, preferably a worldwide survey, not just in the Northern Hemisphere with white people, but we'd encounter places where people were reporting a great deal of alienation. And then, of course, the word means I am foreign, and everything and everyone is foreign to me. It's this sense of being not just turning away from the world, but the world turning away from us. And this is, you know, it's a painful feeling, and I think some of the more, pardon the expression, enlightened Western clergy and mystics and so forth, they actually are identifying that alienation with sin. which I think is a very kind of developed understanding, rather than doing a bad thing. The actual sense of sin is alienation. So since the teaching is that really we are anything but alienated from one another, then practice must have something to do with the end of alienation. And of course, another way you could say that is the end of suffering. Since primarily the kind of suffering that Buddha was interested in is the suffering of alienation. Which basically is finally at the root of all the other sufferings, big and small, that we encounter in our lives. And then I was also thinking about we're encouraged to put effort into our practice. In fact, in Suzuki Roshi's lectures and so forth, that word crops up a lot, making effort. And of course, he was careful to specify that it needs to be pure effort. And pure effort, as we know, is effort that's not aimed at any particular result. So I was thinking, you know, a perfectly reasonable question was, if people say, well, you put all this effort into practice, and in return you get, and then there's a sort of blank. I mean, you know, what about the payoff? I mean, for goodness sake. Practice seems to be very difficult, at least at times anyway. Seems to be, I say. And usually if, well, I would go and talk to my teacher about painful and difficult practice was, we'd wind up talking about effort, you know, make more effort or something. Not always, but sometimes. So the what effort does, as far as I can see, among other things, is it drains the energy from alienation. Alienation is a rather cramped posture that the body-mind can assume. And just as if you were, I don't know, standing on one foot or something, it requires constant attention. It's pretty hard to stand on one foot and then just kind of forget about it for more than a short space of time before you fall over. So, in the midst of alienation, we're constantly having to renew the posture of alienation, or it will change into something else. But since it's such a profound habit, the body is so accustomed, the body mind, so accustomed to the posture of alienation, it doesn't even know that that's what that is. It just seems like that's how life is, man, some people write. stories and make movies about our dreary, alienated life without actually recognizing that there's a view in there. There's a drishti that is fed, that is draining energy from our miraculous, ungraspable life. So as we make this effort in practice, naturally that effort has to draw its energy from someplace. And by some magical calculus, it seems to draw its energy from those drishtis that are imprisoning. And that process is so subtle. Kind of so unlike what we are expecting, you can't actually see it happen. Let alone get in there and like speed it up or something, you know, crank up the volume or whatever. Can't really do that. So, and then, the other thing that I would hear about a lot if I went in to complain about my practice, in addition to effort, I'd hear about patience. Being patient. In the midst of this process that you can't really get a handle on, so even, you know, if we spend a lot of time studying Buddha's words and the words of ancient practitioners, well, you get a handle on something, but it's not really the practice. You get a handle on stuff that people have said about practice, or stuff that their practice has inspired them to say. But the practice itself, it's not in there. So this, you know, it's helpful if we can be patient with that blank, you know, at the end of the question. Put effort into practice. And the result is blank. If we can make that an incantation, you know, to invite us to the practice of patience, it will be very helpful. And then by and by, as we cause a leak in our alienation, the energy maelstrom, the vortex of alienation, gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And your sense of alienation, being alienated, being a poor, miserable, helpless, slug-like sentient being, gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And then in return, you get blank. But the blank is it's pretty interesting. It leaves room for all manner of things. At first, of course, it may just seem like, well, this is just blank. You know? I mean, I'm kind of glad not to be feeling alienated, but now it's just blank. And then eventually you start to notice that that's not quite right. That the blank is so spacious that there's room for all kinds of things which are helpful to others. And there's lots of room for beings coming and going, stuff arising and passing away. And the more the alienation leak, the longer it goes on, the more effort we have to give generously to practice. And therefore, the more energy leaks from alienation. At some point, somebody decided to kind of wrap up this whole package and call it a vow. This is a vow to dedicate any and all available energies to ending alienation for all beings. And then, as we've said, well, of course, someone then asks, great, I love that. There's this great vow. This is excellent. So you make this great vow, or rather you kind of participate in, or you're initiated into, or whatever it is, this vow, and then you do blank. Yet again. There's another blank there. Because there isn't any, you know, menu or user handbook that tells you what to do next. You have to wait for the world to come to you with its requests and needs. And that actually is almost instantaneous. As soon as you become aware of, or I don't know, step into, or allow yourself to be embraced by and to embrace this vow, right away the world is at your door knocking, asking for help. And if you're not too tangled up with dhrishtis, you just help. You don't have to have some great plan. You just, okay, what's next? What do we need here? What can I do? Just very simple, straightforward. And living in that fashion will definitely encourage other beings to let their alienation drain away. So that's one story about the path, so you say, the marga in Buddhism. And it's a bit different for everybody. And yet at its heart, it's kind of like what I was talking about. Although, yes, of course, what I'm talking about is just another story. And therefore, Suzuki Roshi is, you know, often stressed that, you know, little by little, as he said, you find your own way. What's your own body mind of the vow will be. So thank you for giving this Dharma talk today. Appreciate your help, your presence. Questions or comments? Yeah.
I have one really short one and then one that maybe you can remark on. When you had said you make all this practice effort and then blank, mm-hmm. I immediately thought, make all this practice effort, or you said, and you get blank. Mm-hmm. I thought you make all this practice effort and you don't get blank,
mm-hmm.
which worked a little in my mind. Mm-hmm. Like, oh,
okay. Okay.
And then the other piece was I go through these kind of, I guess they're about half a year contemplations of things about life. And so this one's been about sort of a little bit about the alienation kind of related topic about how we hold ourselves in society sort of at a distance from people. And it seems like everybody has a little bit of a fear of completely opening up to people for various reasons, and safety and being hurt or being taken advantage of, or just, I don't know, probably some of it's just animal programming. Mm-hmm. And so, as you know, I watch a lot of YouTube too.
Yeah.
And this guy will tell you it's my kind of disturbing form of entertainment, but I actually go in themes. Uh-huh. It just happens that way that I start clicking. So lately, the theme has been kind of heavy. It's been returning war veterans and post-traumatic stress disorder that they're dealing with. And I saw this TED Talks and a couple other things that talked about, like, you know, trying to deal with, you know, having insane depression and just anxiety and issues that are really heightened, and several of them take their lives and things of that sort. And I saw this one gentleman talk about his perspective on it. I mean, I've seen a couple different treatments. One is there seems to be a good response to some of the transcendental meditation,
mm-hmm.
and even David Lynch, the filmmaker, has
mm-hmm.
an organization that helps these gentlemen,
mostly
gentlemen, with it. And but I was watching another one where the guy was saying that he thought that a lot of the problem was they come back into this society from being at war, and at war they felt like, even if they were in a group of people that didn't necessarily see eye to eye or get along great as like best friends, they always felt like they were in a group of people that would do anything for
we
them.
They were committed to each other.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then they come back into this society and it's
blank.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, kind of as I was mentioning before, the distance from others that we encounter has to be maintained, because the fundamental relationship is no distance. So that means we're dedicating a certain amount of energy doing this all the time, largely unconscious, largely based on a drishti that if I don't heroically maintain my own supreme ontological status, I will get erased. This is a very, very deep view that most of us have. Therefore, we feel like, okay, you critters, keep your distance, because I'm the sovereign here. And again, this is a tremendous drain of energy. Maybe over time, or sometimes people, you know, circumstances are such, sometimes involving ingesting certain substances, that they will notice that fundamentally there isn't any distance. And this can be, you know, a life-changing experience. But rather than, in my experience, try to uh, find or feel that connection with other beings, the necessary part is to do something about the habit of disconnection first, and then let that other piece take care of itself. So I can't imagine anything much more alienating than running around killing people. That really sounds pretty awful.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, when someone's telling you, go kill those people, and then you kind of have to do it because, well, you said you would, basically. That must be, you know, that in the Buddhist sense, generates tremendous karmic burden. And people who have had to do that sometimes return, if they survive that experience, feeling like they have some immense weight on them. And as a result, the space they need in order to move away from the habit of alienation isn't available. So something has to happen first. Some healing, some treatment. Because in our society, I don't think we know how to take someone back into us and help them be whole again. We have to ask certain specific people to do that because, well, I don't know how to do that. I'm not a psychologist or clergyman or something. So we make it the job of certain people to help them with that. But really, any of us could help with that. Particularly any of us who have, I don't know, given up on alienation and are making the practice effort that is leading to the weakening of alienation, we can be helpful. We can help such people heal from their wounds and come to a place where their own alienation habit can start to be dealt with. I don't know if that is speaking to your question or
mm-hmm.
not. But.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes?
I saw a very interesting piece yesterday. I can't remember where I see it. Oh, links from Twitter. I don't even know where I'm going. It was about a German gun designer who's now in his 50s. And he was having difficulty because he would read, you know, stories about, you know, children accidentally, you know, shooting each other and realize that was a gun that he had designed. And people would also say, oh, but you designed the gun that they used to kill Bin Laden. He said, I don't really care about it. I don't give a lot of thought to that. I'm a gun designer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was starting to keep him up at night. So he's designed a gun that can only be fired by the person, if the person holding it is the one that it's registered to by some, you know, wireless connection to
yes.
the person's wristwatch.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the gun industry in the States has gone absolutely ballistic, so to speak. They can't believe that somebody could, you know, it's just a total violation of the Second Amendment. It just, it's really interesting. So I thought, well, I don't know how he's in pretty deep, really, you know, how
yeah.
he's going to find his peace and
yeah.
alienation. Even he's trying to you know, atone for the consequences of what he's done, and other people now won't let him do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, sort of like poor old Mrs. Winchester, you know, built that house down there in San Jose in order to accommodate all the spirits of people who had been killed by her husband's guns.
Oh, my. I didn't know that.
Yes, that's why she did that. And she kept, you know, more spirits kept showing up, so she kept having to build rooms for them. That's another, so that's like her husband's karmic burden affected her. And then I've mentioned, I know that the movie, The Act of Killing, which is really a masterpiece in its way, which shows these folks in Indonesia who were part of these groups of murderers who ran around mostly killing suspected communists and other people who were thought to be opposing the government, and followed one guy in particular, and the the, to me, riveting thing about the film, among other things, was you could see the karmic burden starting to register on this guy. At first, it's like, you know, oh yeah, we did this, and here's how we strangle people, and blah, blah, blah. And then as the movie goes on, you see it starting to dawn on him what he was responsible for. And he was being physically sick by the end of the film. For some of us, the illness of alienation is going to require substantial treatment before peace that is inseparable from our own deep nature can have any room to express itself in that person's life. And again, what can we do? Well, let's this metaphorical image we have of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion, is one who listens for the knock, or the cry, or the request. And of course, Avalokiteshvara is us. Right? It's not some critter in some heaven somewhere. It's us. That's our capacity to hear and respond. And we have all these hands and eyes that we don't know about, thank heavens. If we did, how would we keep track of 1,000 hands? That'd be a real problem. So it's better. We don't know about it. We just let them work. And how do you do that? Well, first, see what is being asked. See what's needed. And sometimes you won't be able to help, you know, more than, well, tell you what, I'll carry this box to the car for you. How's that? Yeah, that's it, right? For that time and that place. And that's all right. Well, oh, yes?
I was wondering, you know, it's interesting to me how I've heard the metaphor for practice as warrior practice.
Warrior, did you say?
Yeah, uh-huh. Warrior practice. What do you think? I mean, given what we've been talking about, you know, it seems kind of troubling. Like,
yeah.
I mean, where do you think that comes from, or what?
Well, my sense is, this isn't maybe always made clear, but that's about the warrior spirit. And the warrior spirit, as I understand it, is a person whose vow is to enter the fray in spite of fear. Right? And to enter the fray means to hear and respond in spite of fear. So the warrior goes to battle, afraid or not. And probably most genuine warriors would say, oh yeah, we're afraid all the time. But we enter the fray anyhow. So I think that as you say, sometimes unfortunate emphasis gets kind of warped, like it did in Japan in the in recent centuries, when people actually took the Buddha away and tried to turn that into a weapon for injuring and killing others. So I don't think that's what was meant by the warrior spirit, although there are people who still insist that no distinction, body, sword, and opponent, you know, slice, you know. Like, okay, I don't think that's what Buddha had in mind. But the spirit that is willing to respond to the cries of the world in spite of fear, you know, that's the real warrior, in my view.
It just seems like potentially poor word choice, because those people, sure enough, are being very brave or maybe quite scared, but then it's also in the pursuit, can be to serve the purpose of aggression, domination,
yep,
conquering and subjugating another people.
Yep.
And like, that just seems like it shouldn't be associated with.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you, and I, some Dharma lineages have this so-called Dharma combat, and I always wished that they would not use that expression, even though they say, it's okay, we're taking back that word from the realm of aggression. It's like, oh, are you? Well, okay. Actually, some of those Dharma combats sound kind of aggressive to me, but that's, you know, that's just my opinion. But I'm inclined to agree that there is too much risk, and that we should actually maybe be more careful about the terms we use, and not so much combat and warrior this and so forth.
It's true, though, the courage, I mean, to enter the fray when you're afraid is,
yep,
it's very difficult.
And yet, it can be done. It actually can be done. It's like, oh, I'm afraid. Well, here we go. Yes?
Well, that kind of brings my two contexts. One is tantric, where there's a kind of, opposition, or kind of like a shock value to the approach, name things in ways that elicit an opposition or an opposition. And the second is jihad among Islamic. Is it the internal struggle to overcome deficiencies,
mm-hmm,
and or that's the way that a lot of like a Sufi mystic, a good person would interpret it,
right.
But it can get interpreted by others as
let's go kill those people who don't agree.
Outer directed.
Yeah. I don't know if I think I know what you mean about tantra, but I'm not sure if I'd use the word opposition exactly. The part of the understanding in tantra is that you can kind of reach in and work with these dangerous high voltage energies in a deliberate kind of a way, and this is what's behind their use of body parts, cups made out of skulls and trumpets made out of bones and garments made out of bones stitched together and all sorts of stuff like that. These provoke a reaction, maybe not exactly opposition, but they, somebody sees, oh, that's a skull, that, something, there's current flowing now that wasn't before. And in Tantra, the idea is that you can actually work with those energies in a deliberate way. And that, of course, it can be dangerous, and they say that. That's another approach to the path, and some people, for whatever reason, are very drawn to that. And so it's like, okay, good, they have that option. And others of us, maybe a little lower voltage is better. I think for me.
I think Trungpa used the warrior metaphor.
Yes, he did, and it seemed like for him and some other people, that worked. And then there were some others involved who it didn't work for it very well. Oh, yes.
I want to say something about the ordinary way we keep the world away. Many of us, many people. And my concern is that we're making it bad, but it saved us in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. What saved us?
Well,
I want to make sure I understand.
If we're alienating, it might be that when we were little,
mm-hmm,
we had an alcoholic father, and
yes,
we had to.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm,
or
sure.
The precious part wouldn't still exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to give a voice to the wisdom,
mm-hmm,
that's,
yeah,
there.
There's probably no time when we won't have to negotiate no separation. there has to be an ongoing negotiation with other beings. Otherwise, it would be a mess. And some aspect that would be people who have a particular karmic burden, which means that their negotiation of no separation will have some more distance involved as a necessary part of their healing. But I don't think we'd want to say, I wouldn't want to say that such a person could not at some point learn that that is no longer an adaptive, helpful habit. And it's now it's okay to slowly move away from that. But you're right, at some times in our lives, it's a matter of survival. And that, if that's available, then so much the better. I had an alcoholic father, so that requires a kind of adaptation that some other sorts of family configurations do not. And you're quite right about that. But there should also be, you know, for all of us, I've said many times, genuine spirituality is about healing. So that should be available to everyone, hopefully at some point.
And yeah, I mean, it's like everybody understands this, but I just want to say it anyway for myself. I don't think that you're saying that that you, this individual conceived as me separately will suddenly get over all these aversions for all those annoying people out there conceived individually as them, and them. And just be able to, through, you know, an effort of will, say, oh, actually, I like you after all. I mean, I don't think that's what we're talking about.
No, I mean, that would be kind of cool if it happened, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
Yeah.
No, but the thing is, the feeling of I don't like that person would no longer, like, confuse us, you know, or lead us into a whole karmically reactive place. You know, we just have that feeling, oh, I don't care for that person very much, without going anywhere with that. And that's a difference already, and a critical one. Especially if you're a hate type like me. I'm not going to wind up saying, I love everyone, or maybe for more, like 60 seconds, and then, okay, that's over. Okay, well, thank you all again for participating, and we'd like you to stay for tea if you can. And, we're doing this thing now where there's a month with no holiday. The last Monday of the month, we don't have morning zazen. So that means Monday we won't have morning zazen. So any of you who are going to show up, don't. Right? And then evening zazen will happen as usual. Okay. Thank you all very much.
May our intention equally extend to everyone.